KMSU.
Hey, this is John Flansburgh calling for Dustin.
Hey, John, this is Dustin. How you doing?
Oh, hey, Dustin. I'm doing good. I haven't spoken too much yet today, so my voice will be radio ready.
Well, that's good. Yeah, it'll sound gruff and kind of FM soundy.
Yeah, so cuddle up to that microphone and tuck in for a perfect hour of the Eagles.
That's all we play usually on this show is just the Eagles.
Here it is, Your Lying Eyes, the Eagles. My voice is very, very much still asleep.
Well, it's all right. I think we'll be good. And we're hoping to maybe get rid of some of the Eagles songs and play some more of yours. And can you tell us a bit about, this Dial-A-Song project you guys are working on?
Oh, the response has been great. It'll be interesting to see what the... it's such a misguided thing that we've embarked upon. It'll be interesting. Everything about it will be interesting for me. Just as a challenge to get through the year with 52 interesting songs and not just have... for people who don't know what I'm talking about, They Might Be Giants basically in the January resurrected this Dial-A-Song service where basically we have a phone line playing a new piece of recorded music, and we are doing a new song every week for all of 2015. So... that we started with a very healthy basket of songs, and we're still feeling pretty strong about it. But it's gonna take a lot of coffee before the end of it.
Yeah, I suppose you guys are starting over fresh. You know, every Monday morning with no ideas and just have to come up with a new song for the next week.
I wish that's what it was. I mean, I guess that's what people kind of expect. We're just too nervous as writers and people to just let it be that. The truth is we have to do a lot of advance work to get these songs together. There's videos for all the songs, and some of them are quite elaborate. We have to... in order for them to be available for purchase, we have to deliver them to iTunes, I think, 6 weeks in advance. So everything is kind of scheduled out, and it's not as spontaneous as it could be. So maybe maybe that's disappointing to people. But I think having good videos and having it sort of a little bit more organized is actually okay. I mean, we might, as the year goes on, I suspect we're going to experiment more with very demo-y sounding songs.
Sure.
I think that would be a fun thing for it to be. I guess it's very self-defined, you know. We don't know what it's going to be until it's actually happening. But right now, they're full productions and fully produced videos. And people seem to be digging on that. So it's just an interesting way to reintroduce the band to the world. You know, we've been making albums for a long time, and it just seems like that format is just kind of a cultural assumption now. You know, people don't necessarily hunker down and really listen to albums. I find that when we release albums a week after they come out, people will be like, all right, so what's next for you guys? And it's just like, but we just put out an album. You know, like, can't this be next for a little while? You know, so there is no new, the concept of new has been redefined for better or worse by the culture. So we're just kind of working with that subtle shift, cultural shift.
Yeah, definitely an ambitious project. Hopefully the people, like you mentioned, aren't hearing it, you know, on a Monday and then by Wednesday are looking for the next one, you know.
Well, I think some people are. You know, I think the reality is if you look at just like the social media and the way people live their lives through their computers, it is kind of a hyperactive space. And I'm not saying that that's so wrong. I mean, I think in some ways we're probably uniquely qualified to be those people's number one band. You know, we're dancing as fast as we can. And it does make for an interesting project. It's just like, you know, it's after I get off the phone with you, I'm going to be like wrapping up a song, and it's just an interesting challenge. You know, it's just so nuts.
Sure. Well, yeah, you mentioned They Might Be Giants have been making albums for quite a while. Can you maybe go over some of the early influences you guys had? Because, I mean, you yourselves really kind of influenced a lot of people after you came up.
Well, we have some pretty disparate influences. I mean, a very big influence on us early on was a band called The Residents, who were out of San Francisco.
Sure.
And they're a very singular band. They were faceless, which I think we found to be really fascinating. You know, it was a mystery what they looked like, and I think that idea appealed to us tremendously. And then beyond that, their music was just very interesting and enigmatic, and it was all electronic. And they really had their own sensibility. They just seemed to have sort of escaped the gravitational pull of pop music. And I mean, I think, you know, beyond that, a lot of our influences are more straightforward in a lot of ways. I mean, I think we were into Frank Zappa a bunch, and there was a lot of glam rock bands, the band Sparks, who I just recently did a project with Franz Ferdinand, which is kind of fascinating to me. And, you know, we love David Bowie, and then, of course, we were exactly the right age when the punk rock new wave moment happened, and I think that had a really profound influence on us, because the sort of extended jammy guitar rock of like the mid-70s and the sort of extended jammy art rock of the mid-70s were both so elephantine, and you know, there's so many 7-minute long songs that shouldn't have been 3 minutes long that we were all kind of happy to suddenly have the short punchy pop song return, and that's what happened. I mean, there was a tremendous number of fascinating new songwriters on the scene, and all these very short pop songs that kind of harken back to 60s pop songs.
Sure.
And that was really interesting to us. So, I mean, that kind of got us to thinking about making music ourselves.
Yeah, and early on, you guys were, I guess I'm going to say, bare bones as far as, you know, it was just the two of you and the backing tracks. And, you know, eventually you added a full backing band. What was your decision to do that? Was it just time for change, or?
Well, it was a sort of, you know, we entered into that really in a provisional way. We didn't know that going with Sidemen would last as long as it ended up going. But basically, when we started, you know, we were home recording enthusiasts. I mean, we were kind of a generation that grew up with tape recorders and synthesizers and multi-track recorders. So we were, you know, making recordings as opposed to being a garage band. You know, everybody's familiar with the band with a couple of guitars and a drummer just bashing it out in a garage. And it's a very sort of social thing. Our origin story is really wrapped up in home recording. And so we would write our songs kind of in a, you know, a sort of a fever dream on these tape recorders. And then when we started performing, we kind of wheeled out the tape recorder as our accompanist. And we worked with drum machines, but we also just worked with tape loops and other sort of less orthodox sound making devices. And to be perfectly honest, drum machines weren't really that fully evolved at that point, and the ones that actually sounded like drums were really expensive. So we had this kind of DIY, high-tech, low-tech setup for the first 5 years of the band. And then a lot of things changed after we got a couple of albums into it, and we started started, and the biggest change of all for us was that we went from playing in clubs to playing in theaters, or playing in really big clubs, where the last row was really far away from us. And that kind of redefined what we were doing just on a theatrical basis, because it was just a bigger show. Like we didn't really decide to make it a bigger show. It just became a bigger show. Right. And that's exactly the kind of thing where you can address it or ignore it, but it is different. And we ended up taking on a live band, and that had its own challenges. It had the immediate advantage of it was that it just seemed way more direct to a lot of people. It was the show became much more celebratory. A lot of people started dancing at our shows like crazy, and it just was a blowout kind of party show, and that seemed fine. But in some sense, I think we lost something very singular about what we were doing. I'm not sure how long we could have lasted if we had stuck with that format, and it'd be interesting. I feel like it's sort of an undocumented reality. The bands that worked with drum machines, I mean, there probably aren't that many of them. This should be a Wikipedia page. Like, Depeche Mode worked with drum machines, sure. Right? And of course, Kraftwerk worked with drum machines, or sequencers. But I think they all kind of faced the same. I mean, Kraftwerk just remained frozen in amber as a project. But
yeah,
I think basically when the early 90s came around, I don't think there was anything less progressive than a band working with a drum machine. I mean, it was sort of like, one of the strange things about being a band for 30 years is that you see all these overwhelming cultural and musical tides turn. And one thing that happened with the grunge era is that there was just it just sort of pushed everything from the 80s out of the way. That was fine. But it suddenly, I think, talking about it now, I think we should have just stuck with the drum machine. But at the time, it would have been like sticking with an asymmetrical hairdo. It just would be a very strange kind of contrarian. I think we would have ended up just being the guy working at the Kinko's wearing a Beatle wig, going like, "There's no band as good as the Beatles, man." It would just be a very strange thing to stick to, which is not to say that I don't love drum machines. I mean, I still work with drum machines all the time, and in weird ways, like that actually is our authentic selves. I don't mind that they sound anachronistic. I kind of love them. That's sort of the story of the thing. I guess. The macro answer to the question is, because we were playing in these much larger venues, I think if we had stuck with drum machines and a track, we really vividly ran the risk. I mean, the other side of it is we ran the risk of coming off as like a Milli Vanilli kind of band. Because once you're out of a cabaret situation where everybody can see what you're doing and everybody can see the tape recorder or see the drum machine, there's no illusion being put forward. But when you're playing in a 2,000 seat place and you can't even see the face of the person on the other end of the venue, it might come across, the same show might come across in a different way.
Right. You guys are a band that have had a lot of diehard fans, from early on. So did you find there was maybe some backlash from some of the early fans when you guys moved to the full band, or moved to Elektra and that sort of thing?
No, not really. I mean, the moving to the band actually happened after we were working on the major label. There's sort of that idea has kind of floated in the They Might Be Giants documentary film, and not to just be a contrarian, but I don't really think it was very controversial moving to a live band, and I think that, you know, actually the whole as much as one would love to make a pinata out of the major label scenario, I think when we started working with Elektra, it seemed like there was a very strong feeling like maybe our side is winning more than anything else. It didn't seem, I think it sort of surprised people because we had had so much success on indie label. But, you know, alternative rock in general, college rock was such a big selling thing in those years, that, you know, I mean, we were certainly not the only alternative rock act that sort of made that transition. And I think in some ways, if you're a self-defined band, I mean, if you're really doing something real, you're not going to be defined by, you know, who your publisher is or who your label is, or, you know, it's just not that big a part of what you're doing. I mean, it's a very kind of high fidelity working at the record store kind of conversation to think about labels and major labels versus indie labels. And there are indie labels that are very bossy. You know, there are indie labels that exploit their artists. It's not like all indie labels are so nice. So it's a very easy thing to just say like major labels bad, indie labels good. Just from an artist's point of view. I feel like I'm being completely contrarian now. Can we talk about blurred lines a little bit? I've got some contrarian ideas about blurred lines.
Sure.
What's your take on blurred lines?
I like the version Marvin Gaye did better, I guess.
Well, it brings up this interesting thing. I mean, the court case, I guess, is, you know, at first when the decision came down, it seemed like the world kind of just sighed a little bit of relief, which is like, yes, because that song is so plagiaristically obvious. I mean, and the first, I nearly crashed my car the first time I heard the song because I just thought, this is the most transparent ripoff of Got to Give It Up I've ever heard in my life. But it brings up this interesting problem with plagiarism. I mean, I think it's an interesting problem, which is that if you're going to have any kind of rules about plagiarism, you have they have to be created. There's something slightly arbitrary about creating plagiarism rules, but those rules exist, and those rules are really about harmonic, you know, melodic information. They're about chord structure. They're about things that are very quantifiable. And the strange thing about the difference between Blurred Lines and Got to Give It Up is that harmonically, they're unrelated. I mean, one is in a minor key and one's in a major key. You know, they're actually quite different harmonically or structurally. But in terms of the groove of it, in terms of the style of it, in terms of like sort of the vibe, they're identical. You know, it seems like stem cell research. Yeah. You know, there's no. But I ultimately think. The ruling is really just 100% wrong, because just because something has got the same vibe as something else in music, you know, it doesn't mean it's not an original piece of music. The, you know, a vibe in music is a very ephemeral thing. I mean, it's a very I just was listening to Jesus Christ Superstar last night, and man, oh man, it's like a gigantic Stravinsky quotation, but I just don't think that it's that important that, you know, the estate of Igor Stravinsky sue Andrew Lloyd Webber for ripping off like 1,500. I mean, what's weird about, you know, I mean, there isn't just one thing about Stravinsky in Jesus Christ Superstar. There's like 15 things about Stravinsky in Jesus Christ Superstar. And so, I mean, it's like the ultimate, blurred lines kind of scenario, where it's just like the entire vibe of something is, you know, of like a long two album thing is just like kind of a taken. I don't know. It's just it's a strange world in which we live in.
Yeah.
I don't know if the current ruling will prevail, but I find it fascinating. It's also just interesting when the culture at large kind of enters into music business issues, because it's not every day that that happens. And poor Robin Thicke. He's such a mess now.
Yeah, well, I guess he should have maybe used a song as a basis, maybe one that was a little bit more obscure than that song. That was a big hit in itself, so that's... Maybe because it was about Jesus, they didn't want to, you know, that was too hot button an issue. They didn't want to bring them to court and make them look bad.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Like, you know, it's funny how also like the My Sweet Lord case is kind of with George Harrison and He's So Fine. Somebody was pointing this out, that it's that case is actually the exact opposite of Blurred Lines, which is that stylistically the songs are very different, but structurally they're identical. You know, the Sam Smith, Tom Petty case.
Sure.
Is a similar to He's So Fine, which is like the actual melodies of the songs are the thing in question. Like the Sam Stone thing is like this glacial ballad, whereas the Tom Petty one is like this chuggy rocker. But they're the same song, you know, so I don't know. I'm fascinated by this stuff. I mean, speaking as someone, I started working on a song the other day, and at some point realized that it was perilously close to like a Christmas song that like my mother used to sing. And then I actually changed it and realized that the melody shape was almost completely the same as like some bebop standard. And I just thought, my God, there's just like, you know, with all the songs in the world, there still aren't enough for me.
Maybe the statute of limitations has run out on some of those standards then.
Unfortunately, I think they're so well known. it was like a descending thing. I'm trying to remember what the song was. It was like a descending melody or like sort of like I don't know, it's hard to describe. But anyway, that's my rant on plagiarism.
Well, I was going to mention, you guys, I feel like, are in an interesting kind of way where you mentioned being kind of close to more of that indie ideal and being, you know, that way. But you also have had success in, you know, the commercial world doing the soundtracks and a lot of the TV show music and that sort of thing. So you guys really are kind of like in the thick of all that stuff.
The Robin Thicke of it all.
Exactly. No pun intended.
Yeah, well, to be perfectly honest, the moment we got off, I shouldn't say to be candid, when we got off the major label merry-go-round and really got off the write, record, tour cycle that was sort of the professional template at the time, it's really freed us up to do a lot of different things, and I don't think we realized how exciting those opportunities were going to be. I mean, I think from doing the kids, you know, doing kids music was originally a one-off for us. It was like doing incidental music for a television show or doing a theme for a movie. It was just a kind of an outside project. And all those kinds of things are very very different challenges. I mean, doing a jingle is a really different kind of challenge, in part because it's actually a client. You know, there's somebody else besides you have to make somebody happy besides, like, the entire world in the abstract, which I guess is what writing a hit record is about.
Sure.
But in a sense, when you're writing an album, you're kind of writing for yourself. When you're writing a jingle or writing a theme or something, you know, there's actually literally somebody on the other end of the phone saying, this isn't good enough. And it sort of changes you in a way. And I think for the better. I mean, it kind of toughens you up as a writer. Like, you actually, you just find ways of being a little bit more rigorous with the materials, you know. Not that I always agree with the critique of, you know, somebody who's rejecting my work, but a lot of times, you know, over time, I think you come to realize, you come to sort of see what they're getting at. I mean, I remember when we were hired to do the theme to the Daily Show. We did a whole music package for the Daily Show, like the bombastic orchestral themes and all the walk-on music. And we also re-recorded this is very early days for the Daily Show. The Daily Show had only been on the air for a couple of months. But Bob Mould from Husker Du had done the theme. And the recording that he made was it was very aggressive, and it was also relentless. It just was like it just repeated that riff over and over again. And they wanted something that was a little bit more party-like, and they just found it too aggro, I think. So they had us, as part of the sort of package deal that we were doing, we re-recorded the whole thing, and but I remember taking it into the sound man, and you know, we had this mix of the theme, and it had the trombone part that, like, I think, you know, people have probably heard many times, and it had all the elements that are in the thing that became the ba ba da ba da ba da ba ba da ba da that people have heard a million times on the Daily Show, and the guy who did the live sound for the show just, you know, turned to me and just was like, "It's not going to work." And I was like, "What? Why won't it work?" And it just wasn't. It wasn't bright enough. It wasn't. It didn't have enough intensity. And I'm not sure. You know, maybe he was just used to the Bob Mould version, which I think the producers thought was just like too sort of acidic for their purposes. But, you know, I actually asked him for specific notes, and he just was like, "Well, you know, it just doesn't have enough push. It doesn't have enough high end. It doesn't rock hard enough. It's just like too sort of soft." You know, I kind of took that to heart. You know, we actually went back and we remixed the whole thing and just made it much more aggro. And, you know, it's probably actually much closer to the original, but it was an interesting sort of evolution. And it was kind of nice to have somebody just be so blunt.
Well, I gotta say, you know, obviously again, you guys have been making records since the early 80s, and a lot of your fans, like I mentioned, are diehard. They've been with you for the long haul. And I gotta ask maybe your sense as to how you and the other John have been able to keep it together for this long without, you know, having some sort of differences, you know, or creative differences that most bands would have?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I think, in a way, you know, because we have not had, you know, simply a successful career, you know, we've had our struggles throughout, and combined with the fact that we actually have had some very kind of easy success, that is, you know, we've never been, I think we've had this sort of we just had a very singular career, and for whatever reason, the events in it have kind of kept us together rather than pull us apart. I think, you know, I think both success and failure can destroy a band pretty easily.
Sure.
But we've had a little bit of each, and not too much of each. So it's worked out. I guess in some ways, you know, we actually, you know, I think at various times we've kind of helped each other through it. You know, I think we sort of, you know, it's we're a team, and at, you know, when things kind of test us, I think the other person can sort of help the other kind of come through it. So there's a very positive thing about doing this kind of thing with another person.
Sure.
And also, you know, it sort of keeps you in perspective. I mean, in some ways, You know, I've known John since I was a little kid. You know, I was a really little kid when I met John. And, you know, so we've grown up together. We've been through all sorts of just, like, kid to teen to adult transitions. And I get, and it's a lot easier when some cataclysmic professional challenge happens and you can kind of talk to somebody and it's like, well, you know, it's like, we're gonna survive this. You know, it's not like this is gonna kill us. So it's been pretty good. I think in a lot of ways it's like it's probably not that different than being in like a brother act or something, except that we don't have like the sibling rivalry issues.
Sure, so, like the Jacksons maybe.
Yeah, or I mean, bands. So many times when I see other bands, I just think like those guys, you know. It's like they don't know, you know, a lot of bands don't know each other that well. You know, a lot of bands just get together in sort of opportunistic ways. You know, they meet each other and then a year later they're like, you know, sharing enormous stages and talking about like, you know, what they think of one another. And I think it sort of pits them against each other. Where, you know, me and John, like we can make references to rock shows we saw when we were 14 years old, you know. I mean, it's like we have so much shared experience beyond just They Might Be Giants that it's it makes it relatively easy. I mean, sure. I wish there'd be some utility in having a little bit more drama in our lives. You know, it's a boring story. You know, two guys get along. But it's allowed us to do a lot of work. It's allowed us to, you know, create a lot of music, and that's been really exciting. And I think it's also, you know, allowed us to do something that's really that is really singular. You know, it's there aren't a lot of bands like our band, and I think, you know, one of the reasons is that we kind of focus the other one up. You know, I think we kind of keep our eyes on the prize.
Sure. Well, yeah, you guys are always busy, and especially now, you know, we mentioned the Dial a Song project, and you guys still managed to fit a tour in there as well. I know you're coming to First Avenue on April 18th. Can we hear, are you going to have some of these new songs, or what can we expect from that?
We're going to have a ton of the new songs. We've been playing every month in Brooklyn and kind of getting a lot of the new songs under our belt as we go, and so it's going to be a very, very new show. I mean, we'll play the favorites, but it's definitely like a very vital time for the band, and one thing about all these new songs is that they're going over really well. You know, it feels like we're playing hits when we play them, so it's a very exciting time. When I think about these songs, like, you know, oh, they're going to play Erase. Oh, they're going to play Answer. Oh, they're going to play Let Me Tell You About My Operation. Oh, it's Music Jail. You know, or it's like, Madam, I challenge you to all these songs that we're doing that are really new songs feel very, very special. And, you know, that's to be, you know, 30 years deep into something and feeling psyched about doing songs from last month. Feels very cool.
Sure.
There's a song that we're doing that's coming out next week. The Dial song for next week is this track called Underwater Woman. And it's such a cool song. I mean, I guess it's like got this crazy fuzz bass part on it that's just very intense and sort of grindy, murky thing that Danny Weinkauf played. And the video was put together by Mark Merrick, who people who follow They Might Be Giants would know from the the cover to She Was a Hotel Detective, the vinyl. And he also did the animation in the Cyndi Lauper video She-Bop, which is,
sure.
You know, like very memorable in its own way. And it's a whole video done in that style, and it's fantastic. It's very sad and strange, and you know, it tells the story of this woman who's living underwater, and it's just great. It's just like it's such a great song, and I can't believe it's not in the world yet. So So it'll be exciting, you know, just to see the response.
Yeah, definitely sounds awesome, and looking forward to seeing you at First Ave. And
by the way, actually, it's going to sell out momentarily. There's only like 100 and something seats left. So if people want to get in on it, they should move, because sure. it's going to go clean, as they say, in the music business.
Well, John, again, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time and being on with me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you. I got another one coming up in just a couple minutes, so I got to dash.
Thank you, John. Have a good one.
Talk to you later, Justin.
Bye-bye.